From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It's the Craig Needles Podcast. It is the Friday Roundtable at ClassicRock981.com, LondonNewsToday.ca. And we are live today, friends, from the Covent Garden Market.
Woohoo.
Everything's here. The mics are here. We are good to go. We'll see how everything sounds. It's kind of a little bit of a test run situation, but we are live and we are here and we're ready to go. And of course, the Craig Needles Podcast is powered by our friends over at the Covent Garden Market and at downtown London. I am thrilled to be joined here in the studio by political insider Scott Collier. I'm also joined by former city councilor John Fife Miller, and London's budget chair Elizabeth Peloza is here with us as well. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Heidi.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin. There's a few things I wanted to get to this week, and two of them kind of go hand in hand pretty tightly. We'll start with the West London thing, then move to the London plan portion of this. There's a whole lot of talk about building large buildings on Wonderland Road, which is where a lot of people already live. However, there are some concerns that we are zoning that as a transit village, but we did not actually do the transit in that end of the city. So if we want to start building large buildings like that along Wonderland Road, which is already pretty traffic heavy, what do we actually do about that to make sure that it goes all right, Elizabeth, to make sure that people can actually get where they need to be without it being a traffic nightmare? I know people were talking about the widening of Wonderland Road. I still think that was a bad idea, but what other ideas could we have to make sure that goes a little bit more smoothly?
Yeah, last term of council, we did remove the Wonderland Road widening from the budget plans. I voted in favor of removing it. That if we're talking about road capacity, it really is making sure that people have different means of transportation to get to work, that it's adequate buses service in those areas. And in order to have buses be viable, we need certain intensification along routes to make it a corridor that the buses are going to want to have frequent, reliable service on.
So how do we do that? Because right now there's construction going on in the south end of the city. There's construction going on in the east end of the city for bus rapid transit. Obviously, the west version of the bus rapid transit plan did not get through. And Scott, I'll get you to talk about this in a second, but there's some concern even right now from London Transit about, hey, how are we going to be able to service these rapid transit corridors? So what do we need to do in order to make this happen?
Yeah, I think it's a wider conversation with partners at LTC of what those plans look like, as we're still building out the bus rapid transit plan. I know some residents, I'll hear from them of, you know, you move into a neighborhood because of the feel of it, and that we should only be doing development on the outskirts of the city. And that way traffic can all flow into the city at once. I have the same development plans coming forward. A few just came public yesterday, including at White Oaks Mall. Building up on the corners there, and people said, you know, we would just approve one across the street of 1,000 units. But we need nodes for transit to be viable and go to and from. Or we just keep building like we've been doing, which I know some people would be happy with, and we just keep sprawling out into single family neighborhoods, which most people can't afford new builds, or a lot of them can't,
right,
especially with the housing market. And we need a mix of everything on the continuum of housing to get people into market and to be able to live in the neighborhood that they want to live in, that you either work in or have a family connection to, or your schools. Like right now, people are all disjointed because they can't find affordable homes in the area of the city that they want or need to be in.
John, obviously the West BRT thing was a conversation that got pretty intense, and they wound up not doing it. I know there's some talk about maybe different ideas for sort of a Northwest corridor, and maybe that helps the situation. But right now, it's hard to get to the west end of the city if you want to drive there at certain times. And if people want to live there, then it's going to get even more difficult if there are more people, unless there's other transit solutions.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, one of the challenges, and again, I live within walking distance of the downtown. When I get up into that area of Wonderland and Oxford, I fully recognize that the decision I made to live within walking distance of downtown was a good decision at the end of the day, because I didn't really have to get up there. That said, when you get into that space, it's extremely busy. And let's be honest, we're looking at one building right now. We've also seen some plans come forward for the ESAM development, which is going to literally be a little bit east of that development at the end of the day. There's a lot of people in that space. I think an east-west corridor system is going to be something that we have to look at. I understand why council didn't move ahead with the west leg originally, but I think, as we see in the London plan right now, the London plan is outdated. Maybe some of those plans at the same point in time and some of those decisions at some point are going to have to be revisited.
Yeah, I think there are parts of the London plan that are certainly outdated, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Scott, you know, I mentioned you're on the Transit Commission. There's concern right now, and I've heard it from Stephanie Marantette, who's on this podcast a little over a week ago, telling me that, hey, we don't know if we're going to have the capacity in order to run rapid transit the way the city wants it to be run. So if we can't even do that, how are we supposed to service West London with more transit? Is that a concern you have?
It is, and it isn't. I mean, one, I think, you know, we are going to need to probably rehab the conversation with respect to the west and the north legs of BRT and understand, you know, in view of the new master mobility plan, what, advanced transit looks like if we don't have BRT. And that's going to come with a price tag, of course. The BRT business case actually is good because it sets us up from a capital perspective for the rolling stock to actually have the buses to operate the service that's included in the business case, plus a year's worth of operating, which will actually, when BRT kicks off in 2027, will get us into the next four-year budget cycle. So we'll actually be able to appropriately plan for that. Going back, you know, even pre our current BRT, London Transit actually did have a plan to have BRT in a different sense, where it was, you know, not dedicated bus lanes, but it was actually really what the express routes that you're seeing now, the 90 series bus routes that you've got. So Oxford, for example, has got the 91. Wonderland doesn't have a 90 series bus route, but I, you know, would expect for sure, just, you know, given the amount of north-south traffic that we've got, that, you know, that would be something that we'd be looking at in terms of service improvement. LTC, we're actually working with Dylan right now to actually do our five-year service plan. So that is, you know, being investigated as we speak, and I expect that's going to be a recommendation that comes back, is that in addition to BRT, we are actually going to need, you know, crosstown buses that neighborhood, you know, feeder loops actually feed into, that then move people, you know, say across Oxford, across the Dundas corridor, across the Commissioner's corridor, and then north-south, whether it's, you know, Highbury, Adelaide, Wellington, Richmond, or Wonderland, and I mean, even now Hyde Park, right? I think one of the challenges that we had, you know, just with the way BRT was laid down and the construct of the transit villages, in particular for the west leg, is that the node was at Oxford and Wonderland. And I mean, we know that there is a lot of development, you know, in the city that is further west than Wonderland. I mean, you know, Hyde Park, you get out to where Commissioners and Oxford meet, and then you have got, you know, almost another town that's actually being built out in Kilworth and Kamoka. That's basically sprouted up overnight. And, you know, that's putting pressure just in terms of traffic on roads, but it's also a transit opportunity as well.
Yeah, and I know that there's going to be, and I mentioned it, the desire to look back on the bus rapid transit conversation in the West End, which I think is fair. I still don't think that, well, we should have just widened Wonderland Road is how we should feel about this. I think that widening the road wasn't going to solve the problem. We need ways to get people to the West End of the city and from the West End of the city without having to use their own personal vehicle. And not everyone's going to want to do that, and that's fine. But we have to give people options. Otherwise, you can't keep widening roads forever. And this is the situation we find ourselves in. So when, by your definition, obviously, Scott, this would not be considered a transit village. How could we make it one, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you're having to have it anchored with, you know, frequent transit that, you know, basically, you know, the premise of rapid transit is, you know, is you basically show up at the bus stop, you don't look at your watch to figure out when the bus is coming, and you just wait for the next available bus, and it's along in, you know, 4 to 7 minutes, you know, is sort of the frequencies that we're actually trying to aim for. We can actually, you know, do that with, you know, non-dedicated lanes, traditional bus service, you know, the 90, 91 express buses that we've got, the 92, the 93, I mean, they're showing in terms of proof of concept that we can actually stand that service up. And, you know, my expectation is, you know, if we don't get a West or a North leg to the BRT, that we will harden those services up to have that kind of frequency. Now, it's, you know, it's going to take capital and operating to do that. You know, with the growth that is going to be happening at Oxford and Wonderland and the pathway that was actually laid out in the budget conversation, where it had been previously decided that, you know, going with an assessment growth business case was not the best or easiest path for LTC, just because it's really difficult when you put in a route to say, hey, are you an assessment growth rider, or are you an installed base rider, or, you know, are you just you know, just an existing transit user?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right?
I'll chime in as the budget chair that assessment growth, like, and we know we are growing. We already hit the target projections for population by 2031. We're already there. That allows us to tap into different funds and money to help cover some of the costs.
Right.
And my ward does have bus route 93. It replaced the 26. And I know we lost some ridership over it because now it's a transfer to get downtown.
Right.
And they're just like, now I'm staying on the side of the road. There's not shelters. And they're like, I can't get to the senior center. I can't get to other places. And I'm not using it anymore. So I think as we do the transit too, it's like, and residents thought they were getting the express route and keeping the local service route to get where they need to. And
yeah.
they felt
I think,
that they've lost something.
Right.
But yeah. As we balance those decisions going forward of like, and understand where people are trying to come and go from in the peak times that
right.
needs to be looked yeah. into.
So they have those things in your ward, and obviously there's mixed reviews, but at the same time, these big buildings that we're talking about on Wonderland Road, they are coming in at the south end of the city, and we've
yep.
seen plans, well, we know that there's going to be one happening at Wellington and Southdale.
Wellington and Bradley.
Wellington, Bradley.
Yeah, on the north side.
Yeah.
Century City.
Yeah. So
yeah.
there's that, and then there's been the conversation surrounding, and I don't know where this process is, and you can maybe tell me, about having some residential buildings come in basically in the White Oaks Mall parking
yeah,
lot.
Yeah, that's Westdale Development, and it just came out and went public the other day.
There you go, which yeah. I think sounds great.
Yeah, right. And hopefully with a few, it's the dilapidated parking structure on the front. Would love to see that go. And
yep.
there's more property in that area with great opportunities, as there's green space and the community center right there, and that's also going to be a transit hub.
Yep.
Yeah.
And ideally as well, somewhere in that area that hasn't been picked yet, the regional transportation coming in and park and ride. Like, there's great
yeah.
opportunities to really capitalize on other people coming in and how we're going to get their transit fare into
yeah.
our line.
Or potentially people who are working in St. Thomas at perhaps big plants that are coming
yeah.
in there.
Absolutely.
And maybe they
want to
live in London. So that would be an ideal spot, one would suspect, to live. If you wanted to work in St. Thomas and live in London, live at the south end of the city.
Yep.
So there's that
Wartell's
too.
Great.
Yeah.
your
counsel
is okay.
Yeah, you're a big fan.
Yeah.
So that brings me to this question then, as we talk about, well, how are we going to get everybody from point A to point B? And clearly we already have some traffic problems in the city. John, is this something that we're going to have the people move in before we start to really solve the problems, because we need the money that comes from the people moving in? And or do you think that we can preemptively get to these things?
We have to. And again, I look at transit very much as a service. Part of the challenge there is if we don't have those services in place when people move in, the adaptation of them using transit becomes much more difficult at the end of the day. You know, whether we want to look at humans are, I'm going to say they're rhythmic by choice. If I'm moving in and I don't have appropriate transit there, I'm going to drive at the end of the day.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to plan for. Then it becomes much more difficult to get that person out of their car and onto transit.
Once the routine is already driving.
So yep. I think we have to plan for it ahead of time, have that system in place, so that when those people move in, they look at that as a viable option. Because it also gives them the opportunity as a viable option to say, I don't need a vehicle. You know what? There's appropriate transit right here. I look at my daughter when she moved to Toronto. My daughter didn't have her license, didn't have a car, but was very specific that she wanted to be on a transit route in order to be able to move around appropriately. if we have those systems in place, it allows people to make those decisions before they get there.
Yeah, and that's what I want to see as well. And we don't have these same types of conversations we're talking about building large things downtown because A, in a lot of cases, the service is already here for transit, and B, a lot of people who are coming to move downtown are doing it with the express intention of I'm going to walk to work. Or 100%. I'm going to walk to where I'm going. This, you know, doing that on Wonderland Road, it's a different conversation because there are just not as many things that are going to be right around the corner there. I want to talk about density as well. And there was a conversation at City Hall this week surrounding, well, how high should buildings be and how does that conform within the London plan? And Elizabeth, where do you stand on this? Because I think we do need these taller buildings unless our plan is build a whole lot of single family homes outside the city, as you said. And I don't think that is a good plan. So we're going to need some of these tall buildings. How do we navigate this in your estimation?
Yeah, I think that's where the London plan, like you said, I would say the moment it came into full effect was already part.
It was already outdated. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's with any plan, though, right?
Yeah. When you start on stuff, it was a good plan, and when you get there, things have already changed.
Yeah.
That I know the public, when they're trying to engage in conversations, you look at the plan and London plan and what it recommends, and sometimes staff's recommendation, well, staff is always based on the London plan, and council will override it. And some people just say, well, this council, but. Because we're already seeing that. We're 6 years from where we thought we'd be today, right, and trying to adapt to the market we're in and realizing that we still have this huge influx of housing and people coming and people here trying to get into housing, that if that land, what's the best land use planning for that site? And if you're at 22 stories, is 25 gonna be that big of a difference, right, when you look up? Like,
no.
can you see it? Is it gonna be, or is it already in a place with great transit and a walkable neighborhood? Like, what's that neighborhood score of walkability and things that are right there, especially in the South End. If you need the highway, like, we're right at highway access and there's the mall and food offerings already in place, that it's not gonna be people that need to drive around to find these basic essentials of life. And the developer was saying, like, once the footing's in, like, once you go so high, the footing's still the same. So
yeah,
it's not like they're spreading out. Residents had asked that question too. And sometimes it's how it's gonna add to the neighborhood, if there's going to be greenscaping, landscaping, and especially if there's something that's a horrendous eyesore there already, sometimes it's like, oh, thank goodness. Like,
yeah, let's get rid of whatever here that I don't want to see anymore.
Yeah, it's going to make my neighborhood better.
Yeah, and the footprint thing is a big one because would you rather in the same footprint have, you know, 22 stories at, you know, 10 units a story, so that's 220 units, or would you rather have 250 if you go to 25 stories?
Yeah.
You know, it's, and if it's the same footprint, it's like, maybe we need the 250, like, if we have this much of a housing shortage.
And part of my push with developers have been asking for those three-bedroom units.
Yes.
I realize that they don't
Absolutely.
Make as much profit on them, but it allows multi-generational families
yes.
to get together, families to have an office or multiple bedrooms for the children,
mm-hmm.
and if you're trying to rent and afford market rate, you could have an extra couple of roommates, that it is part of the housing mix that was missing, especially for me in White Oaks. If you're building that close to the community center and there's great schools, like,
let's have a three bedroom.
Let's have the three bedroom.
Yep.
It's an offering that once it's closed and you have, you know, two kids that are of different genders or whatnot, or you have a parent or someone you're trying to come into, or I hear from people who are sharing units with their siblings and their siblings' partners trying to afford a place, that it really opens up the market to more people and their needs.
And that's, I think, what we want to hear and want to see is people having a wide spectrum of things that are available to them for housing, because that shifts the conversation. We talked earlier about, you know, in, you know, that end of the city or wherever, you know, there's going to be neighborhood pushback almost no matter what you do. Almost no matter what the situation is, there's always going to be neighborhood pushback. I like to think that the majority, not everybody, but the silent majority, is going to be pretty reasonable and understand the lay of the land is, hey, we need more housing, and therefore we're going to have to build things in order to make it happen. That's just not always the way it's going to go, John. So there's a matter of being able to tune out the noise a little bit if you're trying to plan the city.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, when you look at an area like the downtown, I think there's one thing that we would probably all agree on here, and that is the regeneration of our downtown is going to come from people living here, not people working here right now. Once people are living here, the demand to work here will come back, definitely. You know, we hear a lot of noise about converting commercial space downtown to residential space. It's costly. And I just don't see that there's a lot of benefits in it, because when you're looking at a lot of the commercial spaces in the downtown core, they're 6-7 stories at the end of the day. I just don't think we're getting the bang for our buck that we want to get at the end of the day. We need intensification in our downtown. There's no question. The only way to get that, unless you're willing to obliterate the history that you have, is to go up. Because our downtown, no matter how you look at it, is small. Small, narrow streets. That's the way it was built. That's the way it was set up. So in order to get the intensification in our core that we want, we are going to have to go up. And you know what? One of the arguments that I hear all the time is that the riverfront is changing. Yeah, but the riverfront changed when this was a field at one point in time, and all of a sudden you looked across and you went, oh my God, there's buildings there at the end of the day. This is the natural progression of any city, and you do have to tune out the noise. I always love the fact the best noise that I get is the noise when somebody's on the 20th story of a building and they say a building is going to block their view at the end of the day, thinking very well that their building must be translucent and doesn't block anyone's view. So
I live in the invisible building. Where do you live? Yeah.
I see that. And you know what? I think in the challenge, and I think Councillor Pelosi hit the nail on the head. Like when I was on council with her, we supported her recommendation for that building that was out at the corner of Bradley and Wellington, because it's needed at the end of the day. And I commend her for doing that, because those are hard decisions, but at the end of the day, you've got to look at what's the benefit for the city as a whole. Sometimes that doesn't benefit the people on the ground that are right there, but for the city, we need housing. We need housing badly.
And like, not to relitigate that one, but it's like, what do you want? Like a half taken up shopping area?
Three-story walkout. Right. Yeah. 2.5 was the ask of the residents.
As long as the Swiss Chalet stays and the liquor store, I'm good.
The liquor store staying.
The liquor store staying. There we go.
But like, you know, it's just. Like you're looking at what's there now, obviously it can be better. No one's going to build a 2.5 story walk up at that in that parcel of land, nor should they.
Right.
That would be a misuse of that parcel of land. I've got to ask you about affordable housing, Elizabeth, because I know there was some criticism about the Wonderland thing as well, saying, well, they're getting this many stories, there should be this much affordable. But you're kind of in a bad spot there as far as the way the province has set this up.
There's no bonusing.
Yeah. So you can't say, hey, I want this number of affordable units for this number of floors. That doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, no. Please, sir, may I have some affordable housing? Like in that, where it comes to, and you hear the resident feedback, if you build the whole continuum of housing, those who want and desire single family homes, they're there. Go move into them. And everyone needs to shuffle amongst where they're at. We also have people aging out of their homes or people downsizing, but I hear from some residents who raised their family in certain neighborhoods, thinking about, you know, Ward 12, that we haven't had new apartments buildings built there in 30 years. They're like, I would love to stay in my neighborhood, but there's either nothing that's apartments to move into, because I want to stay, I love this neighborhood, or anything newer or more modern that I'd want to move into. So sometimes it's people wanting to stay in the same neighborhood to age in place with their community, and that isn't offered throughout the city.
No. Yeah. It, in fact, you could argue the offerings on that are pretty rare. So, Scott, as we look for that continuum of housing that we're talking about, how do we do it other than just say, hey, please, you know, please build many, many things, people who build things?
Well, I think, I mean, there is that, right? Yeah. Is that we have to say yes and we have to get out of the way of ourselves. And I mean, you know, there is, you know, been some delayering of regulatory encumbrance that, you know, has happened, you know, through the various housing bills that have come out from the province. One of the things that I would be looking at is, you know, when we started the London plan, prior to that, we actually had to take a decision with respect to where the primary transit corridors were going to be. Right. And that was actually laid down first, and then the London plan, once it had been cemented, the London plan was actually built on top of that. One of the things that I would really, really love to see is density and maybe even density minimums with respect to buildings that are actually being built proximal to those transit corridors, so that we're not just putting the development in the downtown and at the distal bulbs of the transit villages, that we're actually filling in and building up all along the way. Now, it's not going to get into every single neighborhood. It's not going to get into Clearedale and so on, but at least you are going to have you know, density anchored with, you know, rapid transit and advanced transit that allows people to not have a car, that allows people, as their incomes change and they don't necessarily have, you know, the disposable income, and, you know, I'm 56 and sort of not thinking of retirement, but, you know, we all sort of do that Freedom 55, London Life, cash planning exercise as to, you know, what am I going to be doing when I'm 75? Am I going to want to be mowing my lawn? But, you know, where do I want to move into, right? I mean, I don't want to leave my neighborhood, but, you know, to your point, Elizabeth, like, there isn't, you know, the construction that, you know, going on in terms of putting up buildings that actually would be in my neighborhood that I'd, you know, be able to move into, right? So I think we've got a real opportunity here to, you know, work with the province, you know, work with planning and our municipal decision makers to look at building density along the entire corridor of the BRT as they're laid out, and getting, you know, people there. Because we've got the services that are there. So I think that would be sort of an opportunity for me, to, you know, just sort of talking about, you know, the London plan. You know, I said this before, I mean, as soon as you lay down a plan, you lay down a budget, you know, it's wrong. And you are continually trying to navigate to get to, you know, whether it's a YEE, your end expectancy, or you know, a desired state with respect to plan. I think, you know, we need to look at things just a little bit more aggressively than what we are used to in the past, where it's like, you know, London's just sort of in this quiet little place halfway between Detroit and Toronto that, you know, the people that know about it, you know, we know about it and we love it, but we haven't really had a lot of outside market. I think one of the things that we've seen coming out of COVID is that there's been a lot of, you know, 416, 905 pressure to actually migrate into, you know, a market like London, where you've got high speed internet, you can basically work remotely for any company that you want in the world, and live, you know, quite comfortably. We need to be able to plan for that. I think, you know, probably from a forecasting perspective, you know, we need to be looking sort of at, you know, the aggressive rather than sort of the median forecast, right, to actually accommodate for that. Well, and if we need to dial back, we can actually do that, you know. Yeah.
And the London plan population forecasts were short. And yeah. It's not like, it's just way, way, way short. So yeah, that has to be adjusted as well. And a whole lot of stuff has changed. You mentioned the working from home thing. The amount of office space we need has changed. Obviously, the cost of housing has gone up significantly since the London plan is done. There's just a lot of things that have dramatically changed the way that you manage and build a city.
Student pressure in terms of post-secondary education or institutions, you know, drawing international students. Yeah. I mean, that's put definite pressure on our housing. And, you know, one of the neat things that we can see at LTC is where, you know, people are actually getting on with their student bus pass and getting to Fanshawe, getting up to Western. And it isn't the near campus neighborhoods that, you know, we've planned for. You know, we've got people actually living out, you know, Westmount Mall in the Sifton townhouses behind Westmount that are actually riding to go to Fanshawe. And that's a 75-minute commute when all your transfers line up.
That's a lot of commuting.
I think, too, though, one of the bigger things is that, you know what, we're not a town anymore, and we always seem to want to make an excuse for it at the end of the day. We're a city, we're a major city, and we should be proud of that. And I think sometimes we really challenge ourselves with that. We almost want to make an excuse for it at the end of the day, but that's okay. We are where we are. We've developed a great city. We have, our population is growing immensely. These are all positive things. And so we need to look at it and say, how do we best serve the growth of what has become a major city in Canada now?
Yeah, and there's going to be a lot of differing opinions on how that is going to be accomplished. And I think that what most people have come to the realization of is, you know, we hear all the time, London's a car city, London's a car city. And yeah, the way London's laid out, it is a car city. But we can't be an only car city forever for budgetary purposes, for traffic purposes, for all the different purposes, Elizabeth. Because if we're
it's
planning
not
on...
sustainable.
Yeah.
It's just induced demand. I can't ever widen a road far enough to accommodate everyone who may or may not want to drive on that spot at rush hour at the same time of day.
Right. Yeah, and that was $200 million that we were going to spend on widening Wonderland Road that we decided we're not going to do that. And because I think it made a lot of sense to say, I'm not going to drop $200 million on something that's going to be useful for an hour a day, half an hour at 8:30 and half an hour at 5:30. You know, like, there's better ways to spend $200 million.
I would push back on that just a little bit, and only in the sense that, I mean, the number 10, which runs basically from Western down Wonderland to Southdale over to White Oaks and then basically up to Fanshawe, up Highbury. I mean, the schedule adherence on that route is just awful. And it's because of traffic. And, you know, my seatmate here on the love seat. We got to have a name for this. This is a Cheryl Miller love seat, right? Yeah.
I don't know if Cheryl might want the chairs, love seat. We'll see what she decides.
Anyway, but you know, my seatmate and I were actually out grocery shopping at Sobeys on a Sunday, a couple of Sundays back. It was Easter Sunday, or before Easter Sunday, but yep. Easter Saturday.
Easter Saturday.
And, you know, you were looking for turkey gravy or something,
right?
I was. Right? Yeah. And Wonderland was, like, stopped. You know, and it's okay. That's Saturday traffic. And, you know, we've got Sunday traffic on Wonderland. Like, I mean, I'm one of these people that, you know, I'd be pragmatic. I fully hear the argument with respect to induced demand, and I get that. But at the same time, if you've got a major thoroughfare in your city that is, you know, standstill on a Saturday or a Sunday, that to me says that it's not a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour in the afternoon problem. It's a larger problem. And I mean, you know what? Look at synchronization of lights and, you know, getting more people into transit, you know, having better transit service, you know, there. Completely agree with that. But I also think that, you know, we've grown, 10% in population since we actually took that decision with respect to Wonderland.
Yeah.
Most people came here with cars, or most people got cars when they came here. So, you know, I'm sure we could go to MTO and find out, you know, the number of license plates that are actually registered here in the city and actually track that growth. We haven't really changed the road network in the city either. So, you know, I understand, you know, climate emergency and viewing things with that lens. But, you know, at the same time, we also actually have to look at the cost of just having cars sitting idling in traffic. As well, which also means that there are buses, if we don't have dedicated right-of-ways, that are idling in that same traffic. And I mean, the number 10 in terms of scheduling adherence, I mean, we are putting in service improvement at the end of the month and throwing some more buses on there, and then also instituting express route, which will go from Fanshawe down to White Oaks, which will include the Westervelt Fanshawe campus as well. A lot of traffic there that'll take a little bit of pressure off that route.
And if you're talking about the traffic that you have on, like, the Saturdays and Sundays, like, I'm grateful for the South Costco. I'll do a plug that it's actually bigger in size than the North one, and the gas bars rarely have a lineup.
But the gas bar is sometimes more expensive
than the North. Gas, yeah. Interesting. I did not know that. But if it's a Saturday and Sunday, chances are that traffic and congestion, which if we're in our vehicles, we're the traffic and we're the congestion. If you're not going for work, you've chose to go out at that time of day, and you've chose that route. And you've anchored your decision in wanting that part of that experience, because you know what it's going to be like.
Costco's busy sometimes on Saturdays, I've been told.
Well, it's an exciting
thing. Really? Saturdays and PD days. The 2 days I don't want to go to Costco there.
Only for the jerky gravy.
I heard the solar eclipse was a perfect time to go, though. There was nobody in there.
Oh, there you go.
There we go.
Yeah, lesson learned.
Yeah, so plan ahead for next time.
Quickly on affordable housing before we wrap up on this topic. What do we do on that? Because it just came up a lot this week when we're talking about Wonderland, and we're talking about basically whenever a big development comes up, there's always a conversation. We need more affordable housing. We need more affordable housing. But council doesn't have the ability to say, hey, build me more affordable housing, because what will likely happen is they could at the very least say, we're going to build you zero affordable units and we'll see you at Ontario Land Planning Tribunal. See how it goes for you. Like, that's kind of what they're facing, right? Like,
I think my opinion is it'll happen organically, and I think part of the challenge is when you look at housing, especially high density housing in the city of London, high density housing always used to be to a point affordable in the city of London. It's not anymore I think they've filled a piece. I honestly think they will get maxed, and all of a sudden they're going to say, hey, look, we need to start to build more housing that's going to be low and medium income housing. So I personally think it's going to become organic, and I think it will also become organic. You know, we always joke and say a decade ago, downtown London was probably one of the least expensive places to live in the city of London. It's not anymore. It's not that has changed. But there are other places in London where that type of housing is going to be ideal for. And I'm not saying that down here you won't have it, because you will. But I do think the system itself builds to the demand, and that demand for that type of housing will come. Elizabeth's point is really well made on the three-bedroom units. I think three-bedroom units are key in any building anymore. And I think a lot of that, too, comes from the fact that newcomers, we have to remember, there are a lot of newcomers that come here that have never lived in anything else than other than high-density residential. Their lifestyle isn't single-family with white picket fence at the end of the day. It's what they're comfortable in. They'll always be comfortable in that. So I think we continue to move towards that.
Yeah, I hope that's exactly what happens, because we need solutions here, and I think that everyone is willing to acknowledge it's a problem. We were just talking about it before we started recording the podcast, but there is a new federal housing document, which I've had time to skim very, very lightly, because it came out around, I think it was 11-ish or so. Yeah. So like, I haven't had a chance to actually get in there and read it before we recorded this, but I will do some more skimming and see what that means, and I'm sure that folks over at the City of London are going to be skimming the very same document. Let's talk about one more topic before we wrap up here, and that is suspended police officers. And CBC has done some digging on that, and they have found out that there were a whole lot of police officers suspended across the province, including 16 in London over the last, I think, 11 years was their range, and costing the city about $5.1 million, these suspended police officers who are facing some sort of issue, in some cases criminal, $5.1 million over that 11-year span. Now, I'm no math expert, but I would tell me that that buys you about 10 lavs. So if we are spending $5.1 million on that, that's clearly $5.1 million that no one's going to want to go see out the door for someone who has done something that's not particularly great. Now, Chief Tai Truong, and I will give him a lot of credit here, and this is, I don't think, an easy decision for him to have made. He has come out in the media and said, hey, I've suspended it. Now that I can, as of last year, I've suspended two officers without pay. And I know, and I've heard this from people within the service, that there was some blowback on that. That was kind of negative. I've heard that from several people. So that's not easy. So maybe the pendulum's swinging a little bit here, but at the same time, I think that there is a lot of frustration amongst people in various communities in this province, including here in London, where they see the cost of policing continue to go up, while at the same time, there's literally millions of dollars going out the door for situations like this. So do we think that now that police chiefs can suspend without pay, we're going to see less angst about that, less people who are saying, hey, why are we spending this much money on policing when they can't even figure out what's going on sort of in their own house? Is that shifting a little bit, perhaps, now that we do see officers suspended without pay, do you think?
I guess I can start on this one.
Sure.
That I'm sure the chief got pushback, because mm-hmm. it hadn't been done before.
Right.
But if we're talking about public accountability and trust, and municipally, the police get their budget from municipal taxpayers, and I have very little say over how much they get.
Right.
Then if a person's asking for more officers, I'm always curious of who's off, who's suspended, who's on leave, who are they going to come back from leave? Because mm-hmm. in addition to those officers not being active and on duty, it's also the issue of Londoners still need police available to respond to a call. Mm-hmm. But how can I get more officers and attract them to the City of London? It's a great place to live. We make sure there's a great quality of life, but there's only so many spots in the police college to train officers mm-hmm. that we're all trying to pull from.
It's competitive, clearly.
It is competitive. And part of that is your work culture, the town you're going to be living in, servicing in, do people have a connection to the city, and the public perception of the police and the role they play in the community.
Yeah.
And everyone likes to be appreciated at work.
Of course.
We all have parts of our job we don't like, but overall, like, can we appreciate each other for what they're trying to contribute to the community?
Right. Yeah. And I will say this, and this is what I always say when cases like this come up, and there's been several in London where officers have been in high profile cases, in fact, where officers have gotten in trouble with the law and they've gone and come back and been paid the whole time. I will say this, if I were a rank and file member of London Police and I knew that the reputation of the service was taking on damage for people who were doing not good things, that would really annoy me. But that, like, from the outside, this is me looking from the outside, that doesn't seem to be the culture there. The culture is, okay, we circle around and protect whoever's in trouble here. And that maybe is something that needs to change or be altered. I have talked to a lot of people who are typically not necessarily fans of the police that really like what they hear from Tai Trung and really like what they see from Tai Trung. I think that's interesting. And I think that I don't know how easy it's going to be to do some culture shift stuff within London Police or police services around Ontario, but I think that there are going to be some things he's going to try to do, and we'll see how successful he is. Where do you think the community's at on this, John?
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think there are some challenges, and Greg, I've talked to you before about this. I've never, in my family, I have two officers, my brother-in-law, his daughter, and his father were all in, all worked for LPS. I think there's a couple challenges here. I think one of the challenges that, to me, this brings out is the mental health challenges of officers right now. I think that definitely is something that is at the forefront. I like the steps that the chief is taking. I think what I do like is the fact that it's left to him to make that decision at the end of the day, and I think that's his role. I think that's one of the things you have to take on when you want that
job. If you're going to be the chief of police in a city like London, you're going to have to make some choices that people don't like sometimes.
100%. I think that is really important. But I always go back to one of the things that I remember when I did a ride-along. I did it with an officer that had been an officer for 30 years, and he said to me, you know, when I started this job, he said, I might have seen one dead body a year. And he said, now, he said, I can tell you I probably see one a day. And he said, that's an oddity that, he said, it is really difficult to get used to. I read through the article you sent me. I would never justify some of those things that were outlined in the article. But I do think that there is a mental health issue there that needs to be dealt with in order to get some of this stuff under. And I think part of that is, again, talking to them, the number of people that just aren't showing up for shift. One of the biggest issues I hear right now is the solid training that's getting done. They're training people at Aylmer. They're coming out in a month later saying this job isn't for me.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of have to. You should be able to make that decision prior to that role.
Yeah, can they get a ride-along first?
Yeah, exactly.
I enjoyed mine. I learned a lot.
Yeah, but you learn a lot, right? Yeah, I think you learn
a
lot.
Maybe in an eye-opening type of way.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think it comes back to, and we've always joked around, and I know but a two-tier policing system where I have the opportunity to get some experience and so on and so forth before I hit Aylmer. Because I'm going to be honest. As a cop, let's be honest. You don't have a lot of fans out on the street. At the end of the day, and you're never going to have a lot of fans. Some people can adjust to that. Some people have a really difficult time adjusting to that.
Scott, where are you at on this conversation?
I'm going to take it a little bit differently, just in the sense that, you know, London Police Service is no different than any other large employer, right? And, you know, you are going to have administrative and disciplinary issues with any employee in terms of things that happen in the outside of the workplace that get carried into the workplace that may result in suspension for a variety of reasons, right? Case law basically says, you know, generally that you should be paying the employee while they're, you know, being suspended until the issue has been resolved. So, I mean, we've got that. I mean, I appreciate the fact that, you know, the chief, you know, has got sort of a light of accountability shined, you know, upon him where he's having to, you know, make decisions and actually lead. And I think that, you know, is great and a responsible thing to do. But I mean, just sort of understand that, you know, the City of London is a municipal employer with, you know, how many ever thousand employees. I'm sure they've, you know, got employees that are under the very same situation that unfortunately, you know, don't have that light shone upon them in terms of, you know, making that decision.
It's a little bit different from the perspective of, okay, your job is enforcing the laws and you've been breaking
them. You're sitting outside of the law right now, and we have to wait until that gets resolved. Yeah. And, you know, you are entitled to your due process and assumptions of innocence until, you know, proven guilty. And, you know, again, case law going up to the Supreme Court, and I think it was 2004, basically said, you know, you have to pay the employee unless there really is a true and countervailing reason not to. So I appreciate, you know, where the chief has actually, you know, gone on this one. But as I said, you know, when I'm not particularly concerned in terms of, you know, incidents in the City of London as compared to, other jurisdictions.
London had like a slight, on a per capita basis, London was slightly higher than more.
I think like 2.4 versus the average of 2.
Yeah.
There was also somebody out there that was like 11.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not really, you know, necessarily too fussed by that in terms of, you know, that being kind of the clickbait headline. You know, for me, again, you know, I actually like the fact that the chief is leading on this and, you know, that, you know, he's working within the boundaries that he's actually got. So that's good.
Yeah, I think that there are incidents along these lines. And in some cases, they're unavoidable because there are going to be people who do things that are not good, like you said, in every workplace, in every walk of life. But there are incidents along these lines that when we're talking about the reputation of London police within the community, stuff like this is damaging. So therefore, how the police respond to it can in some cases mitigate some of that damage, if not, I don't think you can eliminate it, but just mitigate some of that damage. And I think, okay, we're just going to let this guy sit and be paid for 3 years while we figure this out. That doesn't mitigate any of the damage.
Right.
So if we're just talking about it from a pure PR perspective, I get what you're saying, though. And I think that there's got to be some sort of middle of the road solution here, because we can't just say, oh, you've been charged with a crime. Well, you're out. You're right. We're not paying you anymore, because that's going to get challenged in courtrooms and you're going to lose. So is there, to me, an interesting solution I heard proposed online, which I don't think is ever going to happen, is you say to whichever police association it is, whichever police union it is, hey, you pay this person whatever you want, and if this person is found not guilty in the criminal justice system, then we will reimburse you every cent. We as a police service reimburse the union for every cent they've paid this person. Again, probably not going to happen, but I think that's interesting.
I'd throw some interest in on that too.
Yeah, sure. So toss some interest in, whatever you want. Because that way the union is now the ones deciding, okay, do we want to pay this person? Like, how likely is it that this person is not guilty? And now they're the one deciding. And I think that the unions may not want that thrust upon them, but I think that's interesting from the perspective of like, okay, if you're going to pay for someone who's going to be found not guilty, that's great. You get every cent back. If that person's found guilty, you're out the money and you can deal with it. I don't know if that's something that anyone would be interested in, but I like that from the perspective of, hey, you know what, if you really think this person's innocent, that's great. You can pay him as much as you want, and then we'll cover it for you. But I just don't know if that's something that various associations are going to want to be a part of, because that gets into politics from the association and various messes that go from there. I just thought it was interesting that we're starting to see it shift a little bit. And I think that there is, I think, a public shift here as far as how people, not just in London, but around the province, how people feel about the cost of policing and what's associated with that and the accountability that comes with that. And that's not to say that all London police officers are doing a bad job. That's not true. I've said on this podcast many times, when the chief and Ali Chabar came in here and made their case, hey, we need more officers, I agreed with them. I think that case was very reasonably made. If you look at officers per capita compared to other communities and the workload and all this stuff, I think they very reasonably made that case. But there is going to be, because it was such a big bill, and Elizabeth, you know this because this is your job, because it was such a big bill, there's going to be scrutiny that comes along with that, right?
Absolutely, and a request for transparency and accountability. And also, we know what the wait times are.
Mm-hmm.
And we would need employees available to reduce that wait time. So that's just, you need more HR, and that's like the biggest budget line item they have is the employee costs of salaries.
Yeah. And yeah, again, that was one where like, okay, we need money for more officers. I'm fine paying that bill. That's okay with me.
And I do fully recognize that, as we talk about like poverty and mental health issues, that you can't police people out of poverty.
Right.
And the police are not set up to deal with all the mental health and addiction issues. That is other levels of government who need to start funding and stepping up and putting those programs in place.
Yeah, and I would agree with that 100%. Entirely. And I think that most frontline police officers would agree with you entirely.
Yeah, that's not what they signed up for either in their training.
Agreed.
No, and you mentioned like John's, you know, seeing how often one sees a dead body. How often is that going to be someone who is overdosed?
Well,
probably pretty regularly, sadly.
And I would tell you, my niece told, again, in a conversation, said her job when she goes out, when she's in the downtown area, her job is to go from overdose to overdose. That's what she does. That's what she polices at the end of the day. It's a bad use of that officer's time. They could be doing other things instead of that.
Yeah, and obviously there needs to be more treatment options available for someone who might be on drugs so they do not overdose. That's 100%. that's the main thing, the ground floor thing that we would
and
love to see.
Officers can only see so much themselves before they're off on.
Yeah, that's and, right. And you're getting burned out. And look, like when you do certain jobs, you're signing up to see people who have died from time to time, a coroner's office, whatever it is. But overdose death could be particularly difficult. And,
agreed.
Yeah, and. Just, you know, when and look, I'll be straight up. I don't like whether the person survived or didn't. I don't know. But have I walked past, you know, paramedics and police officers responding to someone who was clearly having a hard medical time on downtown London streets? Yeah. Several times.
Yeah.
Several times.
That's a monthly occurrence for me in the downtown.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's not that much less than that for me, if not closer. Because, you know, my when I'm going to the regular office at 700 Richmond, I'm basically walking from one end of the downtown core to the other, from my house to there. And you see a lot when you're doing that.
Well, it's like when I come downtown with Hamish, it's the same thing. It's, you just see all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
So you see a lot. So I get why, you know, for me, it's like, okay, something that happens every couple of weeks and that kind of just, you know, it feels not great. If it's, you know, taking up your entire day, that would wear on somebody.
Yeah.
And I would never.
I think, you know, this really speaks to, you know, the notion of better mental health supports for, first responders of all stripes, right. Where they can decompress and, you know, they don't have the home pressures, right? I mean, just in terms of when you have that, you know, continual noise inside of your head and in terms of just managing the stress, a lot of times you externalize and, you know, it's the people that are in your household that, you know, end up, you know, being on the receiving end of that. And I mean, that's unfortunate. I mean, it, you know, results in instances of, you know, criminality and spousal abuse and all sorts of other sort of downstream things. You know, where, you know, I wonder if we actually spent more time looking preventatively with respect to, if we can't eliminate the problem, we should at least be able to triage the response of our first responders to that problem, because of, you know, just the immense amounts of stress and burnout that they, you know, endure in, you know, a relatively short period of time, right, from a career perspective.
Yeah, and that's, if you're having constant turnover, that adds to the cost of running the service, and there's a lot to consider. And we will leave that conversation there because we're running up against the clock, and I promised these folks would be in an hour, and it's almost 1 o'clock. So thank you so much to Scott and to John and to Elizabeth for coming in and having a conversation with us today here at the Covent Garden Market, the very first time we've done the podcast here at this studio, and it's nice and comfortable in here.
I like
it. It's nice, yeah.
Thank you to our friends at Lazy Boy for the furnishings.
There we go.
Yeah, they're pretty good. And so we'll be doing the podcast here every Friday going forward, with the exception, of course, of next Friday because I'm on vacation. So thank you to all of you for being here today. And thanks, everybody, for downloading this episode of the Craig Needles Podcast, which, of course, can be found at classicrock981.com, londonnewstoday.ca, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Craig Needles Podcast is powered by the Covent Garden Market and downtown London.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.